ॐ स्थापकाय च धर्मस्य सर्वधर्मस्वरूपिणे अवतारवरिष्ठाय रामकृष्णायते नमः। श्रुतिस्मृतिपुराणानाम् आलयं करुणालयं नमामि भगवत्पादं शंकरं लोकशंकरं। This is the last session in this series, so I would like to deal with some of the most important verses which come to towards the end of the text. Those of you who have got the text, you can just keep in mind. 40th verse. The 40th verse deals with these three experiences, the three levels of human consciousness or awareness, called the waking state, dream state, and dreamless or deep sleep state. Technically, this is part of the Mandukya tradition, but it is briefly referred to in this text. What it says is this: in waking state, we are experiencing things at the gross level. We are making use of the mind and the senses of perception and senses of action to experience various things. And in dream state, the experiences change. And in deep sleep state, we don't have any experiences. This is a matter of reality. Now, Vedanta tells you this this phenomenon, this changeability, as a message for all of us. What's the message? This world as such, this world of experiences, doesn't last for long. It is not unreal in the absolute sense, but it is not everlasting. So once we understand that this empirical reality is not eternal, that will give us a great peace and happiness that will enable us to cope with the problems of this world in a more intelligent, effective manner. See, the 41st one is Vyavaharika Jivo Yes, jagra vyavakarikam satyam pratyedi mithyedi manyade paramarthikaka. What it says is, those who are in the waking state, for them waking state experiences are the only reality. That's what we are experiencing actually. See, why do people suffer? Why do people feel unnecessarily anxious about things? Though intellectually they know these things will change. That's because in waking state, we consider the waking state experiences as the ultimate and only reality. It is the idea that this is the only reality that makes us obsessed with that. I gave this example day for yesterday. When we encounter a problem in the waking state, I mean normal life situation, people get so much worked up about that, excited about it. So not only as a philosophy, but as a great psychological tool, this has got this sent a very powerful message for all of us. At the time of encountering empirical experiences, we somehow forget that it is only empirical. And we rather believe it is the ultimate and only. Now here there is a contrast between what we know to be sure at the intellectual level and what our mind accepts in practical life. See, our mind doesn't always agree with our intellect. Actually, we all live at the mental level. Human life is 99% of the level of emotions, attitudes and feelings. Intellectual convictions can help us to modify our emotions and attitudes only if we focus and concentrate and contemplate on the higher ideas. Then slowly, these higher ideas at the intellectual level, we slowly percolate, come down to the level of emotions and feelings. Otherwise, emotional life at one side, intellectual conviction on the other side. You know everything is, you know God is only reality, or you know the world is only a changing phenomenon. Okay, but with every changing momentary phenomenon, we get obsessed, we get enslaved, we get excited. We lose our sleep over that. Why? Because what we know at the intellectual level, that means the momentariness, the changeability of empirical experiences, that we forget in real life. So from conviction level to emotion level, you come down several steps below. So what this text tells you is that a person who lives at the empirical level, waking state experiences, considers waking state experiences to be the only thing. May go to university, read about the higher philosophy, and may be fully convinced sincerely, well, these things are bound to change. Everyone who works in the Wall Street will know the stock markets go up and go down. You don't have to be a philosopher to realize this. A doctor will tell you, any doctor can tell you what our body contains. Our body is nothing but a skin bag. We should not get upset over that. A skin bag which contains things which we will use, which if you touch, we will use sanitizer to eat our food with, which we won't like to touch with our fingers unless we have soap or water with us. This is the reality. Everyone knows that. Any doctor, anyone who works in a hospital, even a child knows that. And anyone who goes to a crematorium will know that when this body is pushed through this tube, everything is over. But still people struggle hard, whitening their teeth and blackening their hair, trying to reverse the metabolism of human body, knowing fully well, one day this will be pushed through the tube and will end up being a piece of stone which will be visit once a year, put a few flowers there, and we may keep that. Now you know, in every funeral services, they provide in some places a small tube containing liquid flash, which if you put in there, you can weep and cry also for the time being. So that is an additional facility provided. So all these show that this body and what it contains are not eternal. This is reality. But this reality, this fact we all know, doesn't help us to sleep well, to sleep peacefully, when we understand we lose money when the stock markets go down. So you can see a terrible, a most unfortunate contrast between what we know to be the fact and how our mind takes those facts or respond to those facts. So that's why at the end of the, towards the end of the text, there is a famous verse which gives you a glimpse into the state of a mind, the state of the mind of a person who has succeeded in integrating what he knows to be the changeability of empirical experiences and his emotional response to that. I mean, his emotional response is in perfect agreement with his intellectual understanding of the changeability of the world. Dehabhimane galide vijnade paramatmani yatra yatro manoyadi tatra tatra samatheka. It's a very profound statement. Everyone can memorize this, at least English translation, if possible. What it says is, when this attachment to this physical body disappears, then that means when this intellectual conviction becomes a matter of inner emotional conviction, then what happens? Wherever our mind goes, whatever our mind connects with, it will remind ourselves of the empirical nature of these things, then you get samadhi. Samadhi here, you should understand, that means a deep contemplation on the unreality or relativity of all these empirical things, and simultaneously the conviction of the transcendental truth that is beyond all this. We have something within us other than this body, other than this mind, other than this intellect, other than this body that falls sick, other than this mind becomes anxious and unhappy, other than the intellect which again starts wavering. There is something in us that enables us to realize this truth. This could come in so many different ways. It could come through some shocking experiences in life. But then again, remember, if we have done a lot of spiritual practices sometime in the past or any time in our own life, in this life, and if we keep that in mind, and then suddenly when some shocking experiences come which convince you these things don't last long, then we will immediately connect with the reality. That was done to Ramana Maharshi. Ramana Maharshi's father died. And he was a very wonderful father, guardian. He was just a young student. And that night he was thinking, well, where is my father? Where has he gone? He all vanished. But this will happen to me also, this body, everything will go. It doesn't mean that you should become skeptical of life. It is not a negative philosophy. It is a high positive philosophy. It gives an intelligence to make a much better use of this body and all the senses, all the mind, all the mental faculties. See, the conviction of the empirical nature, the momentariness or the perishable nature of body and mind will not make you indifferent, will not make you negative in your response to those things. Rather, it gives you the wisdom to make better use of those faculties. In fact, that conviction helps a person to remain even physically alive. Obsession with the body, all those things, when gone, then you're happy. You know, when your body reminds you of its existence, it means you're sick. See, if you have a stomach pain, your stomach is reminding you, I'm here. If you are not aware of your body, bodily existence, what it means, you are in perfect state of health. If you have got excitement and anxiety, neurotic problems, phobias, or some kinds of depressions, what does it mean? Your mind is reminding you, he's the one, he's the master. But suppose you don't worry about your mind, what does it mean? You're gone beyond mind, your mind is in a state of perfect health. So when we become obsessed with the body and mind, we become mentally and physically sick. Okay, this can come as a shocking experience. I'm going to present before you a very interesting episode from the book that I referred to yesterday. Yesterday, we are discussing the experiences of a great philosopher, saint of ancient India called Vyasa, who is supposed to be the greatest author of those days, the greatest philosopher, saint of those times. He became depressed, and his teacher Narada told him that you are suffering because you have not given anything to common people, ordinary people, to help them. That's why you are suffering. Do something for them, you'll be okay. And he wrote Bhagavata Purana, which expounds the story of Lord Krishna. So he became perfectly happy. Now in that book, there's a much more telling, moving story. How this book happened to be written. How it came to be so popular. Now, the story is the story of a king. His name is Parikshit, those of you know. In the first chapter, the first kantha of the Bhagavata Purana, it comes. This king was a very wonderful king. He was very efficient, very successful, an ideal ruler and king, and very, very righteous, perfectly aware of his duties and responsibilities as a monarch. So in those days, it was the duty of kings to move about in different places and help people, sometimes incognito, to walking around, to help people to see that everything is okay in the country, including the forests. So one day he was moving through a forest. He was looking after the welfare of the saints and sages who used to sit in hermitages immersed in meditation. Well, historically, let us say maybe around 6000 BC, let us say that's the early Vedic age where this story must have taken place. Well, one day he was moving in forest and he became so tired and exhausted. He got isolated from his retinue, from his ministers and soldiers. So he was walking alone and he became thirsty and hungry. He saw a hermitage in front of him somewhere and he entered the hermitage, and there inside the hermitage he found a hermit sitting quiet with closed eyes immersed in meditation. The saint who was meditating did not know about the arrival of the king. So he did not respond, he did not greet him. Now the king was hungry and thirsty, and he was fatigued and tired. That sometimes will cause you losing your balance, your mental balance. So the king got angry. Normally he would never have done it, but he was so hungry and thirsty and tired. So he lost his guard and he got angry. He thought the saint was meditating, so he was not he's a minimum courtesy of getting up and offering him a seat. Please sit down. What do you want? Can I help you? You know, that's when you call, give a telephone call, you say, may I help you? So the saint didn't do that. The king got terribly angry. And what he did, he lost his balance in an unguarded moment. He looked around and he found a dead snake lying about near the hermitage. And he had a bow and arrow, he was a soldier, the king. He lifted the dead body, the snake, with his bow, and put it around the neck of the saint. The saint's name is Shamika, and the king was Parikshit. Actually, he was the grandson of Arjuna. He was a great man of those days. So, and he went his way. After some time, the little boy, his son came. Remember, these hermits were not monks. They were retired householders. So you have to remember, if you read the Vedic literature, you find at least 70% of the great saints and sages of ancient India were highly educated, enlightened, retired householders. So there's a Vedic dictum in the Manusmriti. Was a great lawgiver of Vedic times. He says, Grahasthasu yada pasyet vali palidam atmanah apatyasya apatyam tada aranyam samasayet. Is a great dictum, a statement in the Manusmriti. It means an householder, when he sees that his hair is getting gray and his face is getting wrinkled, instead of going to a beauty parlor, he should go to forest. So I mean, apatyasya apatyam, when he sees the face of his grandson or granddaughter, that's also apatyasya apatyam tada aranyam samasyet. So grahasthasu yada apatyasya apatyam pasyet, when a householder sees the face of his grandson or granddaughter, which guarantees the lineage will be preserved. The family will remain in that. What he should do, and he finds his hair has grown gray, face is getting wrinkled. Instead of remaining the home, being a pest to the next generation, they should retire to forest gracefully. The art of graceful retirement is a great message of Vedic culture. Because, and then both husband and wife, who may be middle-aged, maybe in those days, maybe the longevity may be just about 60 years, of course, changed from time to time, they will go to a forest, a lonely place, sit there, and spend the rest of their lifetime in meditation, and more important, teaching scriptures. So many of the Vedic scriptures were taught by retired householders. Sri Krishna's teacher was a retired householder, Sanjeevani. Like that, you find many, the whole Upanishad literature, you find many Uddalaka. This is Chandogya Upanishad. Some of them were kings or Janaka. So they were not all of the monks. They were highly enlightened, retired householders who knew the art of graceful retirement. To be able to retire like that, you should have led a proper life as an householder. Then only your mind will be ready to retire with grace when you reach that age. But your mind should be ready for that. So, this saint was such a great sage. Now his son came after some time, entered hermitage and found the terrible sight. His father was sitting there immersed in meditation with a dead snake around his neck. And the little boy got angry. And he was a very powerful man. He had done a lot of mantras. So naturally he had a lot of spiritual power. And he was a bit immature, impertinent. So what he did, he entered the nearby river, took a few drops of water and cursed the king. Anyone who has done it, he did not know who did that. Anyone who has done it, this man will die on the seventh day from now. He will be bitten by a snake. There's a curse. And after some time, the sage opened his eyes and he came to know what had happened. He was so sorry, so sad. Immediately, he scolded his son who cursed the king. And then he sent his disciples to the king in his court, Parikshit, and informed the king of the terrible curse on him and also warned him, this is going to be true. What his son said cannot go wrong. And the king, you know, the king's response is a great commentary on the highest Vedanta philosophy. The king did not get angry. He smiled, yes, I deserve this. And he decided to renounce his kingdom, renounce his comforts, renounce everything, and he made his elder son, Janamejaya, who became the next king. And this Parikshit came to the banks of the holy river Ganga and sat there in meditation, waiting for the snake to appear on the seventh day. At that time, Vyasa's son, who had learned this Bhagavata story from his father Vyasa, came there to see the king. Many sages had assembled when they heard the great news, because the king did not get angry. He found, that's a wisdom of a person. He was so wise, but he somehow for a moment he lost his balance. So when the sage appeared, I mean Vyasa's son, his name is Shuka, appeared before him, the king puts a question to the sage. And the answer to this question is Bhagavata Purana. In answer to this, the Shuka, who learned Bhagavata Purana orally from his father, expounded the whole story Bhagavata Purana to the king, and this came to be recorded in writing. In the beginning, it was an oral tradition, then it took written form. So the question is very simple. Atha prichami samsiddhim yoginam paramam gurum purusha seha yatkaryam mriyamanasya sarvatha yasrotavyam ato japyam yakartavyam nirviprabhu smartavyam bhajaniyam va bruhi yadva vibharyam. This is a question I shall explain. Now look here, sage, I am going to ask you one question. And you are the guru of gurus, yoginam paramam gurum, you are the guru of, teacher of all yogis. This is a question. Purushas yeha yatkaryam priyamanasi sarvatha. What should a dying man do? Suppose you are convinced that you are going to die in a few days. What should you do? How you should prepare yourself for the end? Our end, in a way, is a commentary on our life, really speaking. So, iha yet kari, what could she do? Withdraw all the money from the bank and go into Hawaii? No. And then the question continues, yasrodavyam adhojapyam yakartavyam nirviprabhus martavyam bhajaniyam va bruhi yadva vibharyam. This question shall go two departments, two aspects. One, what he should do, how he should meditate, how he should prepare, how prepare his family to accept terrible reality, and how he should meditate, could do puja, worship, and so on. And then, what he should not do. Bruhi yadva vibharyam. And what is the opposite of what he should do? That's a literal translation. What should he do? What he should not do. So, in answer to this, the great sage Shuka expounds Bhagavata Purana. So, first he answers the second part of the question. The second part of the question is bruhi yadva vibharyam, which means what a dying person should not do. And no, mriyamanasya means somebody who is going to die. But in a bigger way, we can say how we should confront the unpleasant, unwelcoming idea that this life is not going to be eternal. In a broader sense, we should interpret in that way. Which is an intellectual, a medical, a philosophical truth, and an everyday life truth also. So, that will help us to live our life in a more intelligent way. Very often, you know, people do evil things for two reasons. Either they believe they are going to be here all the time, which is absolutely the opposite of truth. They believe, they know, everyone may know, but when they do some certain things, they believe all these things will be there all the time. Secondly, they believe that this body is the only thing. Nothing beyond that, nothing after that. So, in answer to this question, the sage gives a list of what should not do, and then, in essence, he gives the answer what he should do. The answer is 6th verse of the next chapter is Edavan Sankhya Yoga Bhyam Sodharma Parinishthaya Janma Labha Parapumsam Ante Narayana Smriti. This should be written in every old age home. What it says is through Karma Yoga, whatever we do with a sense of unselfishness, non-attachment, as an offering to God, with a sense of sanctity and sacredness. That is karma. Otherwise, jnana yoga. Sankhya means jnana yoga. We think and analyze and understand and be convinced of the momentariness of all the empirical worldly enjoyments, and that will automatically give us an orientation to a higher transcendental spiritual ideal. Or bhakti yoga, spending our time in meditation, prayer, and so on. Through jnana yoga, bhakti yoga, karma yoga, one should prepare for the final moment so that when you breathe your last, you will be able to see the form of God within you and the name of God on your lips and the thought of God in your mind. So, ante narayana smriti means the last moment you should have this memory. Now, once we realize that the empirical worldly things are not eternal, they are changeable things, they cease to exist at one point of time in the future, then automatically that gives us a deep insight and wisdom into the reality of life. And that will give us a kind of wisdom, that will enable us to handle properly all our resources and faculties instead of being enslaved by the resources. You know, science, technology, social media, We lead to fragmentation of human mind, scattering of human mind, dissipation, distraction. This is natural what happens in modern times. So this ancient Vedic ideal of the transcendental reality of Atman, the divine reality, and the changeability of empirical experiences, they have a deep message for modern times. So look at what happened to Parikshit. This man was an ideal king. That's why when he made a mistake, he realized it was a mistake. You see, if we follow certain disciplines, certain higher ideals, it doesn't mean that we never commit mistakes. What happens, it will enable us when we commit a mistake, and that will help us to go beyond that. That's the only difference. Everyone will commit mistake. But even while living in this world, if we can remember the transitoriness of all these empirical things. Now, this may not come all of a sudden. So Bhagavad Gita gives a great promise. In the Gita, Arjuna, after listening to instructions like this, puts one question to Krishna. Arjuna is asking the question, well, you have taught me meditation, karma yoga, devotion, all wonderful things. Suppose a person undertakes this and doesn't fully succeed, or some, you know, from distraction, dissipation. Sometimes we may not be able to hold fast to an ideal. There could be a distraction. This happens. So does it mean that everything is gone? Life is just one chance, beginning with a cradle and comes to an end with a full stop when the body is pushed through the tube? No. What Lord Krishna says is, death is only a coma, not a full stop of the journey of human life. So the verse that Arjuna says is, Ayadi Shraddhayo Pedo Yoga Chalida Manasaha Aprapi Yoga Sam Siddhim Kam Gadim Krishna Gichadi Kachino Bhavi Brishtha Kachina Brahmyona Siddhi Apradishto Mahabahu Vimudu Brahmanapati. In answer to this, Krishna says, Naki Kalyanagut Kaschit Durgadim Tada Gichadi Partha Naiveha Namutra Vinasas Tasya Vidyade Naki Kalyanakrut Kaschit Durgadim Tada Gichadi. These are three verses in the sixth chapter. We deal with this subject. Arjuna's problem, his dilemma, and his questions, and Krishna's answer is very important. He says, no. What it means is, whatever little you do in this life, you pray maybe a few times and then you forget all about it. It doesn't mean that you should have complacency, no. But suppose you cannot continue your spiritual life continuously, there is a deviation, a distraction, a disturbance, and you feel that you are not fully succeeded. It doesn't mean that you have lost everything. Whatever little spirituality you practice, it could be in the form of karma yoga, helping somebody to cross the street, or maybe sending a small donation to people suffering from many parts of the world, or it's just a noble thought, unselfish thought in the mind, that also an action, mental action, speaking words that may be helpful to others. All these are, or even just thought, prayer. All these activities, even a little bit of these practices, will create a spiritual bank balance for you. And when you are born again, you are born with a checkbook and a fountain pen. It means, literally what it means is, we are not born tabula rasa, John Locke says, empty table, empty slate. No. In fact, Locke's theory is the very opposite of Vedanta. We are not born with empty slate. A lot of things are written on the slate, on the table. Our karmas, vasana, samskaras, good and bad actions are born again. And these good actions, if you have done some good actions in the past, in this life or previous life, will help you to go forward. Not only that, Lord Krishna says, Purvabhyasena teneva ഹൃദയശി അപശോപ്യ സഹ ജിജ്ഞാസുരഭിയോഗസ്യ ശബ്ദ ബ്രഹ്മാദി വർത്തതേ. ദ സെയിം ചാപ്റ്റർ കൃഷ്ണ ടെൽസ്, സപ്പോസ് യു ഹാവ് ഡൺ സം സ്പിരിച്വൽ പ്രാക്ടീസസ് ഇൻ ദ പാസ്റ്റ് ഓർ ഇൻ ദിസ് ലൈഫ്, ഡെയിലി പാർട്ട് ഓഫ് അവർ ലൈഫ്, ദെൻ ബൈ ദ ഫോഴ്സ് ഓഫ് ദാറ്റ് സംസ്കാര ഓർ ദോസ് സംസ്കാരാസ് കമ്മിങ് ഫ്രം ദ പാസ്റ്റ്, യു വിൽ ബി ഹെൽപ്ലെസ്. യു ബി ഫോഴ്സ് ടു കണ്ടിന്യൂ യുവർ സ്പിരിച്വൽ ജേർണി. യു ബി ഫോഴ്സ് ടു കണക്ട് വിത്ത് സ്പിരിച്വൽ ഐഡിയാസ് ഇൻ ദിസ് ലൈഫ്. എഗെൻ if you walking in front of the with the Velova street, you find Vedanta society, let me go and look at it. If you do not, if your spiritual bank balance is empty, then a few minutes you spend and immediately you go away, go to maybe some other undesirable places. But suppose we have a spiritual bank balance, some good karmas in the past, whether we pass in front of a or a any spiritual place, a church or a Buddhist temple or a Hindu temple or Vedanta society, anywhere we go, with any spiritual connection, you will feel a natural inclination to go there and continue our spiritual journey from where we left in the past life or some maybe in the beginning of our life. Krishna says, avashyaka means you are helpless. If you have done some good actions, even if you don't want it, you'll be forced to continue your spiritual journey. So nothing will be lost. You are never late. That's the message of Vedanta. And Krishna, in fact, he reinforces this idea in the coming verses. And he gives an idea of the dynamics of this reconnecting with the good experiences of the past life. Tatratam buddhisamyogam labhade parodehikam. This is the last verse of this particular discussion. So Krishna tells, suppose you have done some good actions in this life, in the early part of your life, and then you completely forgot, and just a terrible deviation. It could happen. The story of Ajamila in the Bhagavata Purana himself. This man was born in a good family, and then during later part of his life, he had a terrible deviation. He became a profligate drunkard, a pest to his family and society. And then, towards the end of his life, he was helpless. He had lost everything. He ill-treated his parents. Terrible things he did. Everything that he should not do, he did. And everything that he should do, he avoided doing. That's the type of man, Ajamila. Ajamila Ubakhyanam in the Bhagavad Gita, the story of Ajamila. So this man, to the end of his lifetime, what happened, you know, he had a son. And the son's name was Narayana, which is a synonym of God in popular Hindu tradition. So this man, he didn't want to call the name of God, because he had done so many terrible things that his mind was clouded. He could not have thought of God. But he was trying to call his son help in a helpless manner. You know, when the body is weak, the senses are neutralized, at the last moment you speak out what is in your mind. You cannot be a diplomat. You cannot smile and shake hands with terrible hatred within. You know, the picture of David Chamberlain and Hitler shaking hands in 1938 treaty, you know, both are preparing for war, hate each other, but they shake hands with smile. You can't do that in life, because you cannot run away from your own mind at the last moment. Whatever in the mind will come out. So what happened? This man was helpless. All the terrible things he did in the past came to his mind. And he found the Yama. Yama is the, you know, he is the chief of hell. He sent his agents to drag this man to his place, to hell. So he was terrified. Then what happened? This man called his son. His son's name was Narayana, is a synonym of God. The name was given to his son when this man was leading a good life, 23rd year. After that, he completely deviated from the path of dharma. So what really happened was, this man called the name of Narayana, his own son. But when he uttered this name, his mind also went back, the early memory, when as a little boy, he used to be sent to the temple nearby. His parents used to train him in devotional practices and so on. So though he didn't want to do that, he didn't mean that, his mind went back to his early days, when at the time, the period when he was meditating, was doing a lot of spiritual practices. Immediately, Vishnu, the god of the Lord of Vishnu, that means heaven, let us say God, sent his agents to bring him there. So there is a dialogue between the agents from hell and the agents from heaven. And finally, the debate was won by the agents from heaven. So Vishnu's agents took him to Vishnu Loka. They said, there's a dialogue, he says, look here, this man has uttered the name of God unconsciously by the force of his previous samskaras. He was totally helpless. That is enough for him to be saved from all the sins he had committed. What does it mean? In Vedanta, you don't lose anything. So, and Vedanta will give this wonderful message. We can start our spiritual life any day, any time, any moment. Nothing is lost, you are never late. Doesn't mean that you should be complacent. Complacency is the very opposite of what is meant by here. To drive home this idea, I'm quoting another story from the same book. The book by Vyasa is one of the most wonderful classics. There is a story, another story, an equally great king. His name was Bharata. So this Bharata was a great king. And as I mentioned earlier, you know, when you retire, when you reach the retiring life, you should know the art of graceful retirement, retiring with grace. So this emperor, when he reached his middle age, he called his elder son, made him the next king, and retired to forests. And he built a small thatched hermitage, stayed there meditating all the time. So that was how he retired. He left behind his palace, his children, his comforts, everything. Now, after some time, something else happened. This person, one day he found a small deer was being chased by a lion in front of his hermitage, a mother deer. And the mother deer crossed over a small stream. At that time, it gave birth to a little child, baby deer. And the mother deer passed away by the effort. And the lion coming, chasing the deer, ran away seeing the king, who was at that time, he was a great ascetic, who had become an ascetic. Now the king, out of compassion, he was a very nice, kind-hearted person, saved the life of the baby deer that is floating in the water. So, he, out of compassion, he took it in his hands, saved its life, and that baby deer grew up in the hermitage. And as time went by, slowly what happened, you know, he became so concerned with the baby deer, giving its food and water, shelter, saving it from wild animals. But in course of time, the king was about to die by the time he had become a great ascetic. Actually, he had left his kingdom and conferred an empire so that he could spend all his lifetime thinking of God. But now, while dying, what happened? He was not thinking of God. He was thinking of the safety of the little baby deer in front of him. Instead of looking upon even the act of giving protection, even protecting the baby deer itself is an offering to God, you know, karma yoga. Somehow he forgot it. He thought, well, he is the one who protects the deer. Without him, it will be unsafe. Which means the idea of God disappeared from his mind. The idea of himself as a protector, as the sole protector of that baby deer, replaced it. So what happened? He died. He breathed his last thinking of the deer instead of thinking of God. And he was born, reborn again as a deer. Because the king was born as an emperor. He renounced everything and became an ascetic. Then, after becoming an ascetic, he died thinking of a deer. And the baby deer, as he grew up, it of course disappeared from the hermitage. But the king was born as a deer. But the king did not forget his past, the lessons that he should learn in the past, because he had renounced his kingdom to realize God, to become an ascetic. So he should have looked upon even the compassionate act of protecting the life of the baby deer as an act of karma yoga, offering to God, good of others. Instead of that, he looked upon himself as the one who protects the baby deer. So the idea of God disappeared from his mind. Instead of that, he himself appeared as the protector, the sole protector of the deer. But the deer did not forget his past. So he grew up in the same hermitage, which is empty. But it was always thinking of God. And when his life came to an end, this deer was born as a great ascetic, great sage. That is the story. So you can see, so complacency has no place in spiritual life. Even postponement of spiritual practices by one day could mean postponement of a spiritual illumination, spiritual realization by several life cycles. So this man forgot the real purpose for which he had come. And instead, he thought he is the one who protects the baby deer. And his realization of his ideal was postponed by one full life cycle. So what does it mean? On the one hand, it is true that nothing is lost. We can start a new life any day, any moment. We should not worry, because whatever little spiritual actions we do, none of even meditation, if you help somebody without any selfish purpose, that also becomes a spiritual capital, put in your name in the spiritual bank. And you are reborn with this. That's why people, sometimes, you know, you find some very old people, very primitive. You find very young people, very much advanced. Because what they have come with, what they have born with, we do not know. Because when you look upon a child, you should remember, he must have been an old man 15 years before. He must have been 90-year-old when you are just 70-year-old. And he's born again now as a child. So in real life, evolution takes place only at the level of higher and higher manifestation of spiritual wisdom. Biological evolution as such is irrelevant in this context. That means once we remember this, then on the one hand, we will not waste our time, energy. We won't waste one day. On the other hand, we won't be depressed. Oh, I am no old, too late, I can't do anything. It is also possible. Complete transformation is possible according to Vedanta, through complete self-surrender. Because self-surrender means just transcending body consciousness. That's a literal aspect of surrender. So what you call surrendering to the will of God is an elaborate science and devotion philosophy of Hinduism. So it is called, in it, just six aspects. It says, Anugulyasya Sankalpaha Pradigulyasya Varjanam Rakshasididhi Vishwasa Goptrutva Varanam Tatha Atma Nikshepa Karpane Shadvidha Sharanaga. This is Ramanuja's definition of surrender. That means you should always think of higher positive ideas, spiritual life, and try to avoid and remove all negative ideas. Then you should think of God as the one protector, the sole protector. And then you should think of him as the one who guards you, and you should have a kind of aversion towards worldly things. Aversion doesn't mean a kind of running away. That should be understood, you know. Once you develop a kind of aversion towards worldly things, you do not run away from the world. You get wise enough to make proper use of worldly things. So that's an interesting thing to remember. Hinduism or Vedanta doesn't advocate running away from the world of realities. The world and its different gifts and powers, you know, the knowledge and powers that science and technology can give us, can be made proper use of And we should also try to avoid making improper use of these powers of nature when we get this wisdom. The wisdom is, we need all these, but they cannot give us eternal contentment in life. After realizing that truth, we must make proper use of it. The difference is, when we look upon worldly things as an end in itself, then we become spiritually enslaved. Then we are the slaves, the world is a master. Once we understand the world and its worldly comforts and the true nature, once we know that they are changeable things, not eternal, then we don't run away, rather we become the masters, and the world and the gifts of science and technology become useful tools in our hands, useful instruments in our hands, which we use only for the good of the world and good of ourselves and not for negative purposes. So it is the spiritual freedom that is essentially the gift of Vedanta in a nutshell. So thank you. Now we'll have interaction. We have just about, I think, yes, 20. No, we have 25 minutes. Okay.
Swami, something that is always needling at me, because we get ideas of both sides of this, where lots of things about how we're individuals and we have multiple lifetimes.
Yeah, yeah.
And then yet we're all one, and Swami will say things like, you know, we all have to be
I know.
So,
I know. I shall explain. Okay, now, you know, in Vedanta, so long as we have not realized or experienced the reality of the one absolute unifying truth, so long as we still look upon our life as an embodied beings, you know, we have to work, we have to... So long as that's our approach, then we have to think of the world as something real. We have to think of humanity as not as one, but as multiplicity. We have to accept the plurality of existence. So when we order our life through devotional practice, through karma yoga, slowly, when we evolve, our understanding of the reality also evolves. Another point that I want to stress again and again is, this cannot be understood at the conceptual level. It is not an idea or a doctrine. Every idea, every doctrine, every concept is only an attempt to convince us of certain things. The moment you take your first step in spiritual life, immediately our worldview changes. Immediately our understanding of our problems also will change. That is an important point to remember. Frequently, you know, we look upon Vedanta as a philosophy. We discuss Vedanta, we study Vedanta, we read Vedantic books only to feed our mind with an intellectual idea of the higher truth. But the first step is to practice unselfishness and devotion. Once we do this and then study Vedanta, then Vedantic truths become clear. It is a journey at the level of our mind, not a journey at the level of academic ideas. So I know that this is a big problem to understand. See, there is such a thing as spiritual culture and spiritual philosophy. Culture is something related to our mind and emotions and feelings. First, we must try to touch our culture and mind and emotions. For that, we must do the preliminary preparatory practices. That's like devotional practices, prayer, and then thinking of higher things, and do some service, etc. That will have an impact on the mind. We should not go about trying for a satisfactory conviction, a logical answer in Vedanta. Logical answer in Vedanta is, logic fails to understand Vedanta. But logic will help you, Vedantic logic will help you to remove all non-Vedantic false ideas.
You're saying, yes, we are all one, but you're never going to understand it through
God. No, we are one, but it is something that you don't understand at intellectual level. It is something that you experience. Swami Vivekananda was a well-educated man. You know, he was not convinced. He made fun of Sri Ramakrishna when he first met him.
Yeah.
And he didn't. Vivekananda did not understand it. Again, his struggle continued, actually. Sri Ramakrishna touched him. He got an idea, but he could not fully understand at that time. But that gave him one strong conviction. There is something other than what we see with our eyes. So when a person sincerely practices prayer or meditation, then you get the first idea, there is something other than this body and mind, something higher than this. That's how you begin your spiritual journey. So I know this problem is always there, especially when you approach it from an intellectual perspective. Intellectual understanding doesn't take you to the highest level of experience. So first we must practice for what is real, what is unreal. We should do that. And we should slowly renounce the worldly things mentally, and we must look upon the spiritual ideal as something which is more real. Nitya, Anitya, Vastu, Viveka is called the first of the four disciplines in Vedantic understanding. Even intellectual conviction of Vedanta is not fully possible unless we practice these disciplines.
Well, Swami, I think I'm looking for something beyond all this. I've actually had some experiences where everything shatters, and I know that it's all love, and I've felt this and I've had these experiences, but
everything shatters.
Short, but also, maybe last a day, but also then we come back and we talk about reincarnation, and yet I felt this, that we are all this one love.
Yeah. So long as we not just be convinced, but experience the unity and oneness. So unity and oneness are not intellectual convictions to be convinced about. That's a state where we arrive as a result of our own spiritual journey. That should be understood very clearly. So the highest ideal is kept in front of you. But it doesn't mean it is yours when you are convinced of its logical correctness. Because what our intellect is fully convinced about may be totally different from what our mind experiences. So how to integrate, how to bridge the gap between what we are intellectually convinced about and what our mind can actually understand? Totally different. But the first principle is, we must practice unselfishness, purity of mind. When we do this, then our intellectual perception also will change. The mind with which we study philosophy, logic, mathematics or physics will not help you to understand Vedanta. Because the mind that is used for learning physics or mathematics is totally inadequate. The mind becomes pure. The intellect should become pure. It is this purity, sense of sanctity and sacredness that will take us to real conviction, intellectual conviction. And after intellectual conviction, it becomes easy for us.
Okay.
Very often the problem, we look upon Vedanta philosophy as a system of philosophy. That problem is always there. I tell you one glaring truth. From a purely empirical point of view, Vedanta may sound to be very logical. Rather, if I can tell you God one day created this world, rules and regulations, you accept this, God, okay. If you don't accept this, okay. That's very easy to understand. That's much more easy for the modern people. But then to understand Vedanta, well, God is something that to be experienced. Not one who sits somewhere with a book in his hand, a list of do's and don'ts. It's very easy. But from a logical point of view, it's very childish. That's why modern Western world is not willing to accept it. But then intellectually Vedanta is convincing, but Vedanta goes beyond intellect. So Shankaracharya's motto was, first you should listen, read books, and understand intellectually. And then we must try to practice fundamental spiritual sadhanas, practices, like meditation, unselfishness, non-violence, yamas, niyamas. That will prepare our mind for a proper intellectual conviction of Vedanta. And then only it becomes real for us, really. I mean, real it relatively. Then it should become an experience. So that's why I mentioned yesterday, when you reach that stage, one important thing is you look upon the whole creation as one spiritual family. That's what happens. And very often, you know, in the higher mystical literature of different world religions, this is experienced, but there is not an established vocabulary to explain this. That's the main problem. Yeah.
Please wait for the microphone. Hold.
No, it's okay. You don't have the answer.
All right. Well, so please wait for the microphone.
Okay, that's all
right. And when you use the microphone, please hold it close to your mouth and speak loudly.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you, Swamiji.
Yeah.
So my question is sort of stems from the concepts you talked about in the very beginning, where our mind understands the concept of, you know, God awareness intellectually, but there's a dichotomy,
yeah,
you know, of practical,
yeah,
application when the world just consumes us.
Yeah.
And then the other concept of surrender, where you talked about,
yeah,
you know, being of the world but not in the world, you,
yeah,
know, kind of,
yeah,
that analogy. And so my question is, when we're relating to people whom, you know, some, you know, they could be friends or not friends, whatever, but when there's some hurt involved or we know they're taking advantage of us or something like that, what are some helpful guidelines or applications in the way where we can still keep that, you know,
yeah,
we're all one,
yeah,
but yet not be, you know,
yeah,
taken advantage,
yeah,
of, I,
yeah,
guess.
Yeah.
And I know, you know, Sri Ramakrishna talks about you can hiss but not bite,
yeah,
thing,
yeah,
but how do we, you,
yeah,
know, actually practice,
yeah,
that?
No, well, we must take steps to counter this problem, to safeguard ourselves, because that's our, that without that we can't survive. But even while taking steps, we should see that we don't create a kind of hatred, deep-rooted hatred or aversion, because that's poisonous to our own mind and our own mental health. That's how Vedanta helps you. See, Swami Vivekananda, for example, you look at the life of any of the great spiritual teachers, they often took steps to counter problems, because that's the very essence of the survival. Without that, you can't do anything. But even while taking those steps, we should safeguard that it doesn't create any deep-rooted, indelible hatred or aversion in our mind, because that will poison our mind. So understanding of the basic unity of humanity, spiritual oneness of humanity, will help us to take steps to safeguard and to avoid being taken advantage of. But still, you can do that without creating a lingering hatred. Because basically, it is at the very subjective level, it will do harm to ourselves and to others also. That's it.
Hi, Swamiji. So this is probably a very silly question, but I'll just ask anyway. In all the concepts that you mentioned about how you have the body and then you have the mind and you have to link it to the higher level from the body to the mind, and then the next higher level you'll have to link it to the intellect from the mind. Essentially, the message that I think I was hearing is, it doesn't matter at some level about the physical body and the mind when you link it up to the higher level. Mm-hmm. But from a practical point of view, for a person who's a working individual who goes to work and comes back, I have to take care of my body. If I'm healthy, then I can help others. At the same time, I have to take care of my mind, because if I don't read technical books, then I won't be able to exercise my mind. So there are practical aspects to what I have to do. I understand that I have to pray, I have to be spiritual, but there is only a certain amount of time in a day. I'm not giving an excuse, but yeah. I have to work, I have to yeah. read technical book, whatever it is, and then I have to sleep. So yeah. how am I supposed to, all the body and the mind are equally important yeah, yeah. too, right?
Yes. Okay, you know, this analysis that comes at the beginning of the text, it doesn't mean that we should neglect our body, mind, or intellect or anything. The text at the very beginning gives an idea that behind the body, mind, and intellect, there is a higher inner mechanism which is the only unchanging thing. It doesn't mean that other things are unnecessary or should be neglected. So that should be understood. You know, so another important point I want to drive home is this Vedantic, highest Vedantic idea is not to be practiced all the time, every minute, when you are working in your office. No. What it is, a basic idea that should be kept in one corner of your mind when suddenly you feel a lot of problems because of some minor bodily or mental problems. You feel crushed, completely crushed and devastated when something happens at the physical level or something at the mental level. So at that time, the real truth that beyond all this, there is one reality that will help you, in fact, to keep your mind and body healthy. So that's why Sri Ramakrishna says the highest Vedantic truth should be kept somewhere in the corner, and then you must work in the world. You don't take Vedanta in both your hands and wield it in your hands all the time, 24. You can't do that. Nobody did that. See, all the great teachers, even after realizing the truth, they lived in this world. They ate food, they walked, they talked to people, and they attended many ordinary problems of the world. Vivekananda talks about the need to remove poverty, untouchability. I mean, he wants to talk about a new paradigm for the West, which is synthesis of the best of the Oriental, I mean the Eastern, and the best of the modern Western. All this he speaks about, social advancement and so on, which apparently has nothing to do with Vedanta, highest metaphysical aspects of Vedanta. But then what Vivekananda means is, at the individual spiritual level, whenever we get obsessed with some minor little problems, the physical level, we should always remember we have something, we have a higher dimension above the physical, above the mental. So it should be kept in a corner of a mind, should not be wielded with both hands. See, if a person remains always in samadhi, there is no life possible. And nobody did that. You look at the life of every great spiritual person, there is first an ascent, and then there is a period of stabilization. Then they live in the world, teach the world, they deal with the problems of the world. Social problems, economic problems, many such political problems. They don't run away from the world. Vivekananda actually wanted to do that. At one stage he said, I want to sit in samadhi all the time. But Sri Ramakrishna, no, you cannot do that. You have to do other. The difference between the work of a person who has reached this level of spiritual illumination and others is, they do all this, but they don't think of their own selfish motives or interests. Others, they may do wonderful things, but there is always some emphasis on one's own individual things. So that's an important point to remember. So all Jivan Muktas, all liberated souls, all spiritually illuminated persons, They have worked incessantly. I told you the example of Shankaracharya. He was going about installing deities in temples. And he was the one who emphasized you should see God outside the temple also. But all people will not be ready for that. Intellectually you may be convinced, but it won't help you unless you are emotionally ready. You become emotionally ready for it only when you experience it. So you find Shankaracharya was an Advaita philosopher. But image worship is at the dualistic level and was going about renovating temples. All day from Badrinath, Indochina border to the extreme south and east and west all that. Tribureshwari in the east, in Tripura, and Saurashtra, Dwaraka in the west and so on everywhere. And he was the one who formulated the puja ideal. All the puja we follow, it was he who put all rules and regulations, everything. So all the temples, how to install temples, everything his creation. And this man was talking about a God beyond temples, beyond images, the God present everywhere. But all people cannot and will not be able to understand unless they undertake an emotional experience-based journey in spiritual life. Not intellectual journey, but experience journey. So that is an important point to remember. If you are not fully able to understand this fact, it's not because it is wrong, but because our intellect, which is trained to understand mathematics and physics and chemistry, is not enough to understand this fact. Because mathematics and chemistry are demonstrable, verifiable facts. You can use laboratories, you can use other equipments to test, but there is no way to test. Your own mind is the testing ground, laboratory for spiritual practices. So frequently that we forget. Spiritual journey, essentially, it begins as a journey at the mental level. And as we practice, our mind also changes. So the questions we may ask today about spirituality, we may not ask tomorrow if you take the first step. When you reach the second stage of spiritual journey, the questions that you asked earlier become totally irrelevant. Not that questions get answered, but questions lose their relevance. Because the answers come from within at the experience level. That's the point. Okay. Okay, doctor.
Swami.
Yeah, just 5 minutes.
Thank you, Swamiji. I had a silly question. Yesterday we were talking about, or you were talking about Vyasa and his... Vyasa, sorry, I'm not saying it right. And his struggles with depression and how he was ultimately able to overcome that by writing a book that defined how to conduct one's ideal life. What book was that and what time period are we talking about?
Well, the book is called Bhagavata Purana. Yeah, it's a book.
Yeah. Swami, not that I'm ready for it, but yesterday you mentioned a couple of, you started talking about how one progresses. You mentioned, I think you said Savikalpika Samadhi, you mentioned the four samadhis,
yeah,
and you described Savikalpika Samadhi. I'm not... But then you did not continue to talk about the Nirvikalpa Samadhi, because we are not ready for it. But anyway, I wanted to ask
you.
It is
something, again, in another place where I conducted a retreat on a similar topic, they wanted to practice meditation. I will tell you what it is. So basically, Samadhi is twofold. Two types of Samadhis mentioned in this text. But the broad category is Savikalpa and Nirvikalpa. So in Savikalpa Samadhi, means it is a Vikalpa, means it is an object. And the central principle is you look upon everything as a witness, as if you are the witness, and what you see is a changing object. But the witness subject never changes. The objects will change. So the Savikalpa Samadhi has got four subcategories, subdivisions. One is based on internal and external practices. External means bahya, means bahya drishyanu vidha and andarika drishyanu vidha, bahya shabdanu vidha and andarika shabdanu vidha. So visual and audio, what you read some scriptures, you listen to something, that's one way. The other one is you visualize an image. That is another way. So the visual is called drishya, the audio is called shabda. Shabda means what you hear. Now both these have got one internal and one external. Now take the first one, for example. Let us say the external visual method of Savikalpa Samadhi. At the beginning, what you do, you look at the sky as one infinite expanse. So you are trying to concentrate on the omnipresent, the all-pervading nature of space, because you want to realize the omnipresent, all-pervading nature of Brahman everywhere. So this symbolism is used as a method for meditation. So you think of the infinite expanse of the sky without or space without any boundary, and meditate on this at the external level. Then in his internal level, he meditate on this same infinite sky as being, as existing within you, because the Atman within you is also infinite as the all-pervading Brahman outside. So infinitude external and infinitude internal at the visual level. Then at the word level, I mean the Shabda, Bahya Shabdanavidha and Andrika Shabdanavidha. First method that is very simple and maybe more easy to understand. See, when we listen to music, devotional spiritual music, or when we chant loudly a hymn or a spiritual statement, we repeat, then our whole mind is concentrated on the audio dimension of that word. So we don't hear anything. The sound from the street or marketplace, everything is gone. Our whole mind is focused, channeled to that sound through our ears, and then we forget everything else. Then that becomes an object of meditation. Well, for example, when we there are prayers and statements in many religious traditions. Suppose you think of some spiritual statement and just got a divine message for us, then we concentrate on that and chant loudly or listen to it loudly. Then again, the same chanting, the same hymn you repeat without making a noise is a continuous natural process. This is what I gave an example of, you know, when in the way of a pilgrim. When the pilgrim traveled from the external to internal, when he realized this, he says his eyes became, he had an overwhelming experience. He felt the presence of God everywhere. But then he was praying without making any sound. The prayer went on naturally, spontaneously, and effortlessly in his inner mind. So this is one kind of samadhi. Samadhi means concentration. Usually samadhi here stands for concentration. Nirvikalpa samadhi is something higher. So the practice of any of these four disciplines will take you to nirvikalpa samadhi. That's one thing. And then at one stage, this becomes sakasa samadhi, where you're automatically, naturally establishing in the higher nirvikalpa samadhi. These are six types. I know that this is a bit difficult to explain in an audience like this, but since you asked the question, I want to explain. Well, at a simple thing, anyone can practice. You all chant mantras, or most of you, or you all sing some hymns, whatever tradition it may belong to. And many of these hymns, if you observe carefully, study, they have got some divine implications. When you chant this loudly, focusing on the divine the implication, with a sense of sanctity and sacredness, then only this higher spiritual concentration is possible. If you read a spiritual hymn, a devotional hymn, with the same careless attitude with which, oh, read newspapers, hymn also, it won't work. Because a sense of sanctity and sacredness, if we attach to what we do, then that helps us to put our whole mind into it. That's what, when you do puja, when you do any ritual in any religious tradition, then whatever you do with a great deliberation. You lift a flower with your hands. If you do that with a sense of sanctity, then whole mind will be on what you are doing. Mind will not be distracted, because we attach this something very sacred. So whatever we do with a sense of sanctity and sacredness, that helps us to put the whole mind into our diet. That is the real purpose of sanctity and sacredness. And when we do that, it has a spiritualizing effect on the mind also. So this sense of sanctity that we attach to whatever we do, it also creates some corresponding mental waves in the mind. Mind becomes calm and quiet and serene. So that's it. Anyway, I can't give more than that. He said, time is up. Thank you, Doctor. Questions? So now, thank you for all the wonderful questions that helped me to explain what perhaps I would not have explained in the course of this discussion. In 46 verses in 5 sessions, you know, it's not any time possible. So now we will have refreshments from 11:30 to 12, and from 12 to 12:30, meditation. This meditation will be in the Shrine Lecture Hall. Thank you. Om Shanti Shanti Shantihi Harihi Om Tat Sat Sri Ramakrishna Pranamastu.